Missing in-person interaction at industry events? Fear not. ATS London 2021 will be held in person on November the 3rd and 4th at the Velodrome in Olympic Park, Stratford. We're going to be discussing the future of the advertising and marketing industry, and we've got an awesome lineup of speakers joining us at this incredible venue. Visit events.exchangewide.com/ATS London 2021 to find out more and to book your tickets today.
The MarTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, joined by our very special guest, who I've only just discovered is actually based in Amsterdam, Simon Peel, Senior Director of Global Media at Adidas. Hello, Simon.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Yes, welcome. And you did confess to sporting a teeny bit of a hangover due to, we are going to have to mark this occasion. We're going to have to say something about this in the podcast. Due to, cue Simon.
Too much beer, too much wine. Yeah.
And lots of celebration.
Lots of celebration because England are obviously in the final of the European Championship. So, yeah, we were celebrating quite a lot at home last night.
Fair enough. And also joining me, my trusty colleague over in the Walthamstow Studios, Lindsay Rowntree. Lindsay, I reckon you were celebrating last night too.
I was, but not so much alcohol. I was well behaved last night. Lots of screaming, but not the hangover. So.
And inadvertently frightening. Yes, right. And inadvertently frightening the dog.
Terrifying him. Yes.
Anyway, I shall say no more about this, except that it's a momentous occasion. And I wish the team the best of luck for Sunday. Can't wait for next week's podcast. Okay. diving into the first news story that I wanted to chat with the two of you. News about expansion of Amazon's publisher services. So actually, this is Amazon or APS, Amazon Publisher Service. It's something that was launched 10 years ago, but they are now putting a very, it's been growing steadily over that time and has become, in fact, the, I think, second most popular SSP, particularly in the US market. And they're now putting some more dedicated resources into expanding their Amazon Publisher Services offering. They're planning to employ some senior executives to develop the marketplace further for both media and ad tech vendors. So trying to create a marketplace for both the buy and to accommodate both the buy and sell side. What's interesting about this is that it is setting the Amazon Publisher Services up to be more than just a basic SSP. Certainly some of the feedback from publishers that are using APS is that it is enabling them to run all of their connections through the platform in addition to Amazon Demand, which is a little bit more of a wider offering than some of the regular SSPs. There is also news incorporated in this of Amazon launching their own identifier, so we can make some assumptions about them building a coherent marketplace, perhaps otherwise known or understood as a walled garden, could be direct competition to the other walled gardens of the industry. And the other important point about this is that they're also looking to broaden their advertiser demand and focus on offering value to brands that don't necessarily currently advertise within the Amazon website and ecosystem. So super interested to hear your opinions on this story. Obviously, the world of identifiers and trying to provide privacy compliant solutions for enabling advertising and marketing transactions is enormously important. And it's really interesting to follow what Amazon is getting up to, because we know they've got their fingers in lots of pies, but they are becoming one of the mainstay players of the marketing and advertising industry. So it's quite fascinating to follow this story. Simon, I'm going to start with you and get your impressions first of this story.
Well, I think it's a good thing. I think having some level of diversification in the in the supply path is a good thing. I'm quite intrigued by it. We don't, as a brand, we don't currently use Amazon's DSP, but we have been talking to them about the combination of their DSP and SSP and how it, you know, they're saying it's a transparent model. So you get to see all the way through the supply path. And I think a larger proportion of the money goes back to the publisher as well than potentially some of the other SSPs. So for an advertiser that's kind of, you know, wanting to ensure that publishers are making as much money from their investment and it's not getting stuck in that tech tax waterfall, I think potentially it's a really good thing for the industry. that's without knowing too much about it. So it's broad brushstroke stuff, but I think it will help publishers as well. You know, the reliance on Google and AdX for the supply path, I think suddenly there's an alternative, particularly if they bring in the identifier as well, because my understanding is one of the attractions of the Google supply path is that you get to utilize the Google audiences. And obviously that's quite attractive for advertisers. So if there's an alternative to that within Amazon, I think that's also quite an attractive thing for advertisers to then utilize and, again, help publishers get more money out of supply path. So overall, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, diversification is, it seems critical to the kind of future health of the industry across the board for many reasons. And it's really interesting to hear you say that, you know, just from your perspective, it's important as an advertiser to think about where within the supply path you're putting your money, you're dedicating your budget and shifting your spend, and to have some knowledge that publishers are getting as much revenue as possible from that transaction is really important to you. That's really interesting. Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, I'm living in some kind of bubble, I think, because I really had no idea that Amazon Publisher Services was quite as big as it was. They are literally a silent assassin. It's incredible. Being number two in the market, having come from like number eight only 2 years ago is ridiculous, really. But I guess, you know, classic Amazon in terms of how they want to be the best at everything they do, and that they'll go away and stealthily do that until they become it. But I think that further to some of Simon's points, like, it's interesting how they're kind of going up, that they're looking at kind of what the two most important things are when it comes to supply path, supply chain. And those two most important things are the people that have the money, the people that have the inventory. And actually ad tech should be peripheral in the middle of it. And so much of ad tech forgets that. Google certainly seems to forget that. And actually having Amazon come along and offer a viable alternative, it's almost acting a bit like almost like a tag manager for all the different SSPs out in the market, allowing publishers to still use many of the SSPs that they're working with and not just kind of rely on Google, but also give a greater cut back to the publishers, I think is important. I think it's a shame that it's Amazon, because, you know, we talk about Gaffer a lot, and if it weren't Google, who else would it be? Well, I guess it had to be Amazon. But I guess there is nobody else. Like, can any of the other major SSPs out there have this stake in the industry? Maybe they can't. What was interesting to me as well was the article said that they are specifically going after non-endemic brands. So they're going after brands that don't currently advertise on Amazon's platforms in terms of how they're courting brands and speaking to them. And it just shows that they know where their limits are. They know kind of it from the e-commerce perspective. You know, they kind of got that nailed. So how do we try and get the rest of the brands that are out there that don't advertise on Amazon, either because they can't, because it's not relevant to them, or because they don't want to and they've chosen not to? We need to try and find a way of getting them as well. This is the way to do it. And that, I think, is a thing I find really interesting. They will not stop at trying to get everyone on board with them.
Yeah, and I'm sort of interested in your point of view on that, Simon, as well, is what would be the compelling proposition for brands that don't typically advertise on Amazon properties?
I think it's not having a pixel on your site. So for us, because we've got an e-commerce element to our business, there's always this kind of concern that you put an Amazon, I don't know why we're concerned specifically about Amazon and not Google, but put an Amazon pixel on our site, they'll steal our data and then, you know, begin to price our products on Amazon.com more competitively. So we begin to lose some of the profit that we make it using e-commerce. I think that's all kind of largely unsubstantiated, but it is like a fear that companies have inside. So I think not having a pixel on the site, which is, from what I understand, you don't need it now. You can just tap into their platform and use the IDs that they've got within there. I think that makes it really attractive. So I think us and other advertisers like us will probably want to try out the solution when it becomes more available.
Interesting.
It's funny what you were just saying, Simon, about the fact that, you know, the fear is it's having an Amazon pixel on your site. And what, you know, why are we not concerned about Google? What we are about Amazon. Yeah. Like, you're not alone in that either. Like, so, why is there so much less trust around Amazon than there is around Google? Because I think Google is just so much more endemic in advertisers' lives. They have been for a long time. Amazon have come out of nowhere. They're known for, frankly, selling crap on Amazon.com, and everyone goes, I do not. And there's just so many dodgy stories about people that try and sell their stuff. Amazon will look at popular products and go make them themselves. Amazon will kind of, you know, eat everyone else's lunch, and everyone's going, I don't want Amazon to be part of this narrative. I don't want to be part of that.
Particularly for brands, right?
Yeah.
Particularly for brands, yeah.
But I think they actually said that, didn't they? They went out and they said, we want to eat our customers' lunch.
Yeah.
I think so. It's pretty difficult to trust them based on that. But yeah, I think increasingly they seem to be a much more trustworthy ad tech solution, especially with some of the stuff that's going on with Google in the US and the Project Bernanke stuff, where there's like this kind of almost hidden bid shading that Google are undertaking. So I think the trusting Google by brands is probably eroding a lot more when it comes to ad tech than previously.
That's interesting. And it feels a little bit, though, that maybe Amazon have got a bit of a sort of a branding issue of their own, right? Is they need to somehow shake off that sort of legacy interpretation of their brand as being this kind of low-value marketplace that then sort of grew into a bit of a tech behemoth who was prepared to eat people's lunch and is now trying to grow up and become a responsible corporate organisation. So, you know, I wonder what it will take for them to shift their brands into that, you know, into a new vision. Maybe they'll apply for B Corp status like Facebook are trying to.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. But I think it is interesting because Jeff Bezos always had this notion that Amazon was doomed to die because any big brand never lasts more than a couple of decades. So it feels like, you know, under his stewardship, it was just growing and growing and growing and growing, like steamrolling and just like a rock rolling down a hill, gathering all the moss, or like a snowball turning to an avalanche, grow to the point where it explodes. But it feels like now they're trying to look at, okay, let's not let that happen. Let's try and diversify and get into as many areas as possible without just kind of having it in the back of our minds that Amazon will die soon. Let's make it as big as we possibly can. It feels like there is, Rachel, I think you said it, there's some maturity around it somewhere.
Yeah, and maybe that's why now's a good time for him to be stepping away as well. That surely he's so loaded, he just doesn't need to worry about Amazon anymore.
Definitely not. It's all about space for him now.
Totally. And I don't know, playing golf or whatever else he's doing with his life. Okay, moving on to second news story, still with a bit of a brand theme. News that some well-known US retailers have started to carry other brands on their websites in a bid to broaden their online audiences and reach across their sites and also to expand their brand reach as well. Some examples given in the article in question was Urban Outfitters, J. Crew. The idea is that not only can they be using these other brands to potentially expand their customer base and also their brand reach, but it also gives them an opportunity to make some commission off those online site sales. There's a bit of a feeling that perhaps they are benefiting from some brands who are, as we've just discussed, slightly suspicious of other third-party selling marketplaces like Amazon and are perhaps more willing to sell their brands via other branded retailer sites. There might also be some brand association that's going along with that as well. It's interesting that Urban Outfitters, maybe less J. Crew, but certainly Urban Outfitters was one of the examples because, you know, Urban Outfitters has certainly been carrying other brands in their store for a long time. So why not online? And I guess for some brands, they probably enjoy the potential brand uplift of being associated with Urban Outfitters. So this is quite interesting. It feels as though it's not sort of, you know, a brand new approach, but it does feel like it's a sort of a popular approach that's growing with a lot of traditional retailers. So what do you think about this model? Do you think it's something that other retailers are going to be trying? Do you think that it's going to be a viable alternative, different alternative marketplace, but also perhaps at a different tier, at a different level for those brands that are not wanting to sell through classic third-party marketplaces that feel much more like a cheaper, less brand-associated marketplace. Lindsay, what's your point of view on this?
I find the whole marketplace notion quite fascinating because I think that when I first read the headline, and this is classic, read the headline and don't read the rest of the article and just make assumptions based on that, I thought that they were actually becoming a proper third-party retailer. So they were actually kind of allowing other brands. I was thinking that's stupid because Urban Outfitters already do that anyway, as you just said, Rachel. And then I read the article and realised it was actually marketplace-led, and they were actually allowing third-party sellers on their site that are, for example, via Express, one of the brands mentioned, the product is referred to as Express Marketplace. Now, if from Express and Urban Outfitters perspectives, it allows them to increase revenue, increase basket share, kind of reduce cart abandonment. Also, I think from a big thing, they'll get more data, they'll get more understanding of the kinds of things that their consumers will buy outside of the products they currently carry, and it helps them branch into new areas without any real investment
into product research,
everything else. They can just start carrying new products immediately. The things that I think about in this are the big thing that first came to mind was quality control. Like, how do you not become an Amazon and allow anything and everything to be sold with questionable quality and questionable, you know, questions of where it's come from, how it's been made, who's made it, if it's legitimate, if it actually arrives, if it's not, if the reviews you're reading aren't kind of accurate or legitimate or have been paid for, how do you stop that? But I guess these kinds of brands are going through a kind of, you know, there are some examples in the article as well, WSJ, about how they are actually going through kind of severe quality control. And there was one marketplace said only about 3% of all the brands that come to us that want to sell on our site actually make it through. So there's a lot of probably time and effort that goes into that. But even then, which is probably similar to how it goes into your own products as well. And I guess it's a great quick way of being able to get more insight, get more data about what your customers are doing, and grow your audience. It takes me back to when, for a hot second, I used to work on the Lidl client at my previous job. And their big challenge to us as an agency was, we do not want more customers. We want our existing customers to buy more from our store. And that just makes me think of that, like, Urban Outfitters have already got like a huge audience. This isn't about them bringing more people to their site. It's about those people that are already coming, buying more from them and not leaving in the first place without making a purchase. Like, carrying more products won't necessarily make me think, oh, I'll go to Urban Outfitters and see what they're carrying. But I might then find more while I am there in the first place. And that's kind of what came into my head. I don't know. I find it really interesting. And I think that it will help them know their customers much better, help them get more data. But for the brands that are selling on the marketplace, will they ever really be able to create their own brand identity? Will it limit their ability to scale if they are only ever selling on third-party marketplaces?
Exactly. Good point. Simon?
Yeah, I didn't read the article properly either. It was on the Wall Street Journal, so I think I don't think I've got a subscription. And I couldn't get into the article. So I kind of misread it, and I thought it was, like Urban Outfitters selling, you know, like the Converse, for example, their website.
Or Levi's or whatever.
Like, well, they already do that. Yeah. So I don't understand the story. But, to Lindsay's point, it's about marketplaces and other third-party companies being able to sell on their website. So utilising the brand of Urban Outfitters to sell other products that maybe don't have the reach that Urban Outfitters has, as an example. So actually, I thought it was really interesting. I didn't know that was actually a model that existed. I mean, obviously I knew it happened with Amazon, but I didn't realise how prevalent it was in the US. I'd spoken to Walgreens earlier this year, and they were adopting a model like that. So that was really interesting. And I didn't realise Walmart is so big at doing it as well. So according to the article, Amazon, I think, has 2 million marketplace sellers and Walmart has 85,000. So that was a bit of a surprise to me. I think generally it could be a really good thing for startups, you know, companies that are trying to establish smaller brands, because they can go to these types of companies and get access really quickly. I think the problem, not for Urban Outfitters, but for those smaller companies, is that I think all the logistical element sits with them rather than with Urban Outfitters. So I don't think Urban Outfitters takes on any of the responsibility. I mean, it's not just Urban Outfitters. There are a few in the article. So for Urban Outfitters or Express, it's obviously a really good thing because all of the logistics sits with someone else. But it's not clear from the article, like, where do the logistics sit? Because with Amazon, it's actually all done through Amazon. You've got the, or you don't have to go through Amazon. You can go yourself, but Amazon provide that service at a cost. I wonder whether there's going to be an alternative that's providing that logistics as well.
And that's a really good point, right? Because that's surely how Amazon attract a lot of sellers, is that they can provide that logistics, those logistics. And, you know, even though obviously third-party sellers get charged for that, it's just not going to be practical for some third-party sellers to ever get the logistics set up for themselves independently, individually. So that is interesting. It, as ever, it will all come down to the detail of various models that are adopted. You know, so if a bit like the Walgreens example, you can imagine a lot of brands will, you know, benefit from being able to sell their products through Walgreens because they either don't need to take care of the logistics and or they're being exposed to a much wider audience. When it, you know, when there's more responsibility on the third party seller, that will be a really different proposition. And then I also wonder what the experience is like for the consumer and for the shopper, because like you mentioned, Lindsay, I'm going to go to Urban Outfitters for things I might think that that Urban Outfitters would typically stock. And if I see other things that interest me, then yeah, I'll stick around. But does that mean I'm always going to think of going there when I want those other things? It's a bit like the same experience of getting your groceries delivered by Ocado, realizing that you've run out of toothpaste and thinking, oh, rather than going to Boots, I'll just get my toothpaste via these guys this time. But that doesn't stop you going to Boots when you think of, you know, toiletries and hair care and whatever. So some of this comes down to, I guess, what impact this kind of building of marketplaces and this cross-selling of branded products has on the brands themselves, and then how that translates to the shopper's experience.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think that, and there was actually one example in the article as well, where there was a particular brand that sells something like $34 to $36 face cream or creams like that. And they sell via a third-party marketplace, wasn't one of the ones mentioned, but it was another one. And they were talking about Amazon and saying, well, I could sell on Amazon, and Amazon are great, and Amazon have all these customers globally. But is my customer there? And well, the answer is, yes, your customer probably is there. But is your customer there buying $34 face cream is probably what you should be asking yourself, because your customer is 99.9% certain there. Like, they're using Amazon to buy something, but are they using it for that particular thing? And that's where this becomes interesting, because Amazon is not a great place for discoverability, I think, because it's so extensive, it's so expansive. You will go there and you will search for something. You know, you go there knowing what you're looking for. You aren't going there to try and find new things to buy. Whereas some of these other places, like I keep using Urban Outfitters because I don't really know Express or J.Crew. There is an element of discoverability. I can go there and find, like, they sell like really random trinket stuff as well as clothes and whatever else. And I can find some really random stuff. I'll go, oh, my friend would love that as a random, like, joke gift. They're the kind of things I might discover on the site. That doesn't really happen with Amazon. Like, I tried buying something on Prime Day recently, and after 5 minutes, I was so overwhelmed, I gave up and was like, this is not worth my life or time. Don't care what I'm going to save. It's not really worth it. And I think that's where the challenge lies for these marketplaces, kind of one, do they want to scale? How much can they scale? And not lose the quality control aspect. But the logistics stuff that Simon was talking about is also really fascinating, because Amazon don't just give you the option of running that for you. They almost kind of try to enforce it. I've read and heard things that Amazon push really hard to get all their sellers to actually run it via Amazon Amazon fulfillment, because Amazon takes such pride in next day delivery and why members pay for Prime, that they don't want their sellers that are doing their own selling to ruin that and to ruin Amazon's golden reputation, using air quotes there. But I think that they're pushing it more and more, and in doing so, they're actually like ranking brands down that refuse to sell via Amazon fulfillment. So the logistics thing is where some of these third party marketplaces could really come unstuck, because it's logistics of it getting there. What am I paying for delivery versus what I would pay Urban Outfitters normally? Am I having to pay more? Will it take longer to arrive than if I pay for next day or whatever else? And can I return it in the same way?
I was about to say, returns is a big thing, right?
Exactly.
We've had several conversations in the office recently about how, you know, there are some of us that actually will not buy products, even branded products, from those branded products websites because the returns process is too complicated. So it's basically either go into the store and buy those products there or buy them on another website where you know that the delivery and returns process is more reliable.
One of the other things I was thinking about is packaging. Because again, when you think about logistics, it's like, well, who's going to send it? Like if it's from the brand that's selling the product, but you've bought it on Urban Outfitters or J.Crew, isn't the expectation to get a package from J.? I know this is really stupid, but isn't it? The expectation is that you get the package from J.Crew rather than this random brand. Again, it's probably be Amazon that does all the logistics for them. You know, maybe that's a new business model. So I think that element, in terms of the other aspects, I don't think that there's any real worry. As long as the products that are sold on the retailers are relevant. By the way, there's a bloody quite big plane going overhead. So if you can hear that, apologies. So, I mean, it would be a bit weird if Urban Outfitters started selling dog food, as an example. You know, actually, as you might be exploring their website, and that might be quite a funny joke to send your friend.
Happy birthday, here's some dog food.
Yeah, it could quickly erode Urban Outfitters' credibility. So I think having that editorial control is probably quite important, but you know, you would assume that these brands know what they're doing when it comes to that. So those would be the two areas for me, like the relevance and you know, strangely, the packaging.
Yeah. Packaging is an interesting one though, because sometimes I buy things and I don't care about the packaging, and other times I really do, which is weird. And I sort of don't like that I do. I feel like I'm being sort of, you know, I feel like that sort of marketing and branding magic has kind of had its way with me, and I'm suddenly more interested in the packaging than I am in the actual product. But it does make a difference. And surely it makes a difference to some brands, right? Like that is the thing that they will want to control, depending on how premium they are. I'm also just wondering, one final thing before we move on to the next story. I'm also just wondering, I wonder if some of this is caught up in what the shopping experience is going to be like over the next sort of like 3 or 4 years, because we've just gone through this period of immense digital transformation that was already on its way, but has been enormously accelerated by the events of the last 18 months. And that's a big deal for any of us that can remember very clearly what shopping was like well before the internet, in addition to back in 2019. But I'm thinking about young people that have grown up during that time and perhaps were maybe mid-teenage, you know, were sort of mid-teenagers in 2019 and are now coming into a period of time where they might be towards the end of their education and maybe they're getting a little bit more money. They've either got, you know, temporary jobs or whatever, and they're starting to spend themselves, and they just shop in a completely different way. Will they just, you know, they might find an experience like this just not strange at all. It might be not weird at all for them to buy their dog food on J.Crew or Urban Outfitters. That is even, I think, more of a stretch, J.Crew and dog food, than Urban Outfitters and dog food. But yeah, I'm just wondering how much this is going to be determined by the next couple of years, and to what extent our digital transformation journey keeps bowling on at a pace, and to what extent the younger generation of shoppers start to inform the way that brands and retailers organise themselves.
I think because they're the social media generation, aren't they? And they say that for that generation, like, brand loyalty is just so far removed from what we would consider to be, like, you know, how loyal we are to brands of this generation. And if they're perfectly happy to buy something off Instagram or buy something off TikTok based on what an influencer has shown them, regardless of what the brand actually is, and regardless of who makes it, where it's from, etc., just because it looks good and someone's shared it, then I guess that doesn't matter. Like, brand erosion probably isn't a thing, because brand creation isn't really a thing in the first place anymore.
Yeah. What do you reckon, Simon?
I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, I've got no stats to back up what I'm about to say, but I think branding is just as important now as it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe even more important now, because there's so much choice. You need something to inform a decision. So I think you need that, that brand and positioning to make sure that you buy what you want to. Sorry, another plane just.
I was just about to say, is another plane going overhead? Because your sound has just suddenly come patchy.
Sorry about that. I live on a flight path.
Evidently.
Yeah, we're moving. So I disagree. I think if I went fishing for the stats, I could probably find it. But I mean, it might be confirmation bias. But nevertheless, I do think branding is as important as it was previously. I mean, even buying stuff on Instagram, you're buying it because it's Instagram. You trust Instagram as a brand. And even Amazon, you know, like they might be eating everyone's lunch and there might be too many choices on there, but still you trust it because it's Amazon, the branding itself. And it's, branding is not just about the adverts, it's about like all of the whole marketing that goes around it, including, again, the distribution and the logistics and the packaging. So I think it's just important that it might be that just some of the selling models change a little bit.
And the way those brands are created in the future might change a bit too.
Yeah,
there's lots we could dive into there, but I'm going to move us on to the next news story. A research report released recently by Ebiquity in partnership with Lumen, which showed that a stunning 1% of consumers' attention is captured by advertising. So that did make us all here in the offices at Exchange Y this morning go, 1%? All this effort for 1%? But there is, as ever, some detail behind that stat. So figures were derived from the comparing the number of ads consumers actively look at with the number that they could have seen, and then adding to this some data from the IPA Touchpoint survey, which is a UK-based survey. So some of the further data, in addition to this overall 1% of consumers' attention is captured by advertising, was that most of the attention went to TV formats, TV advertising formats. They were the more engaging formats of the media consumed. And there was more attention devoted to social media platforms than some other media platforms, except for that there was less time spent per ad on those platforms. So people were sort of consuming a higher volume of advertising on those platforms, but paying slightly less attention to them. And then overall, which I thought was really interesting, is that most attention overall went to newspaper ads. Who knew? I guess there could be many reasons for that. A compelling, you know, a touchable format, or even, you know, if it is a digital format, there's something about press-related newspaper advertising that appears to be gather more attention. One of the conclusions that the article made is that it seems to suggest that if TV advertising formats were more engaging and captured more attention, perhaps that's got something to do with the sort of simple visual and kind of emotional elements of that typically goes with TV advertising. But I guess one of the interesting things to consider there is what kind of format people are consuming those TV ads in, whether that's actually on a large screen, on a mobile screen, out and about while they're, you know, commuting or going from A to B, or whether that's actually at home in the living room. So yeah, some interesting stats. I guess it's not all, you know, some of it's not surprising, but I'm just interested to know where you think this could push the advertising and marketing industry in a positive direction. And Lindsay, I'm going to start with you on this one.
Thank you. That's
A little bit of a curveball.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that, so I had to cut something on the fly now. Wonderful. But no, I think that the 1% thing is the 1% of daily attention to advertising is a great headline, and it's a classic clickbait headline, in my opinion, because then you dive into it and you actually look at, well, that's of their daily attention in general. And you look at what their attention goes, how much their attention goes into commercial media, how much of that then goes into advertising, and how much of the time looking at advertising is then actually recognized and consumed. So if they, was it 90 minutes of advertising they're exposed to a day, and they recognize about 10% of it, which, you know, I thought was more than it might have been, because I think about how many ads I see a day and how many I actually register, and yeah, it probably is about right. But I feel like 10 minutes of advertising is quite a lot for one human to register at any given day, and register and remember it and take it on board. So if I'm taking on board 10 minutes of advertising a day, that's not too bad. But I think it's interesting, and I think that, you know, it's further to Simon's chat about branding, and I completely agree with you, Simon. I think branding is very, very important. I think these numbers prove the importance of branding and how important it is to get your message across in the most succinct way. And often that is visually. And if you think about, you know, if you go back to where attention really goes and the numbers go against TV and press, I think print advertising is brilliant. And I think print advertising is very, very engaging, largely because it's very, very visual. And the only reason that print advertising numbers have fallen so much over the past decade isn't because engagement has dropped. It's because the audience that consuming print has dropped, and that's kind of really it. But if you actually look, think of it as a format of advertising, the same with out of home as well. They're normally very visual, normally very engaging, and they're normally the things that will stay in your mind far more than a 5 second ad on a phone might. So I think that they prove the importance of branding across every medium, not just the likes of TV and out of home and print, but across every medium, branding is ultimately what's important, because the 10 minutes of advertising that I do retain, I'll guarantee you, will have been something that's very, very visual, something that really caught my eye. Mm-hmm. And that's what advertisers really need to remember.
Yeah. Simon?
Sorry, I went on mute because there was another plane. I think it's another great study from Lumen. I really like Lumen. I think Mike Follett, the guy that runs it, is fantastic as well. I actually wish they would stop publishing reports, because, you know, the more people that know about it, the less competitive advantage we have by utilising the data that they send us. There's nothing massively surprising about this particular report, but it's interesting. It came out, I think, in the same week that Karen Nelson Field, who runs Amplified Intelligence, it's a similar type of attention tracker based in Australia. She's brought out a study with Peter Field. I don't think those two are married or related, but they just happen
to have a name coincidence.
Yeah, but they brought something out this week talking about share of voice and how attention affects share of voice. Because if you don't build attention into your share of voice and excess share of voice, then you're kind of losing quite a lot of the advantage that you might have when you come to plan. And to grow market share. So I think the fact that you've got lots of these kind of reports coming out at the same time is really interesting. We've been working with Lumen, or Adidas has been working with Lumen for 2 years now. And we basically ran a few studies about social media versus other types of media. And we were looking at, firstly, we looked at display, or did we look at, no, we looked at video first and then we looked at display. Because a couple of years ago, there was all these problems with viewability on social platforms. You know, it's terribly low because people just scroll through really quickly. And Facebook were kind of making claims that, if it was mainly Facebook, were making claims that it didn't matter too much, which was interesting because you would assume that your ad needs to get seen to have any impact.
Yeah, that it kind of does matter.
It does, yeah. But what is interesting is viewability and attention aren't necessarily the same thing. So what we found was our viewability rates on Facebook were really low, but those that did see the ads had much higher attention. So there's this kind of payoff that you get. You know, is it worth buying the impression if it's not seen by that many, but then when it is seen, it's having an impact, you know, that someone is actually seeing it. It's not just viewable. And some of the other stuff that we got from them is basically like, you know, the best thing to do on, I probably shouldn't say this. I'm going to say it anyway. But the best thing to do on Facebook and Instagram is basically to run GIFs. Like, don't do video, don't do display, do GIFs, because people need some level of animation, but no one's going to watch like a 6 second video or 15 second video. I probably shouldn't have disclosed that. But
we can edit it out if you like, Simon, but I kind of want to keep it in.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Sorry. And then it's also that video works better on different platforms. So like YouTube, you can run a longer video and it will get attention. Whereas, you know, you don't necessarily want to run it on Facebook or Instagram. So I think, like I said, I think some of the Lumen stuff is fascinating. I wish Mike and his team would stop publishing these other reports.
But what's interesting about that, though, is that whole sort of, you know, 1% of consumers' attention is captured by ads. That doesn't sort of frighten you off as a, you know, working for a brand and buying global media.
No, not at all. I think we overestimate how effective advertising is. You know, We're always looking for research and measurement that reinforces the biases that we have, particularly if we work in advertising, right? We want to prove that we're doing a great job. And most of the time, it's just meaningless clutter, to be honest. So it's not surprising. I mean, people have better things to do with their lives than pay attention to ads. Like, who really sat there thinking, oh, I'm desperate to watch this ad? You know, like, I don't think that really happens, or happens very rarely. So I don't think that number is surprising. I thought what was interesting, like the print number is really interesting.
Yeah.
Again, it's like a tangible product. So you probably spend more time with it. You know, you're moving it around in your hands, you're going backwards and forwards to pages. Whereas when you're online, you're just kind of skim reading as well. So yeah, maybe we should be investing more in print.
Maybe we should become more like the Germans. They still have a really big print economy, don't they? Magazines probably more than newspapers, or is it newspapers too? Looking at you, Lindsay, as our resident Germany expert. Yes, Lindsay lived in Germany for a couple of years, like, I don't know, 10 years ago.
So yeah, a long time ago now. So I'm the expert, despite the fact that Germany's probably changed quite a bit in the past decade. Never mind, that's not a problem. But yeah, no, it was, they love a physical newspaper. I mean, even like back then, I used to go up the train, everyone was reading newspaper. Everyone was reading something they bought, like in the UK, in London, it would be, you'd be reading the Free Metro or the Free Copy at Shortlist. But over there, they were reading magazines and papers they had physically bought. And the newsstands were and still are really popular in all the stations and that kind of thing. And yeah, they do have a very different relationship with it, which is nice. I like it.
Yeah. It's also about just sort of drawing your attention visually to different things. I mean, I'm just getting so tired of looking at screens. There has to be something else. I'm also noticing, because I've been obviously getting the train into the office, I'm also noticing a lot more people reading physical books now than there was back in 2019. For sure, loads more people reading books. But you know,
I find myself not actually looking at my phone anymore. I'm staring out the window. I've got a podcast on, staring out the window.
Yeah.
And then people think I'm staring at them. I'm like, I honestly have no reason to look at you. I'm looking at a wonderful view. Thank you very much.
And giving your eyes a rest.
Yeah, exactly. I'm bored of staring at my phone.
Yeah. Amazing. I'm going to move us on to the second part of the podcast, which is just a bit of a chit-chat with you, Simon, about, in general, what you're up to. What I wanted to kick this off with was just hearing your opinions, really, of how you think that the sort of brands and marketers in a general capacity and the marketing industry is coping with the deprecation of third-party cookies and mobile device IDs. How sort of, you know, prepared do you feel for it? Do you think your marketing colleagues in other organizations are for it? What implications is it having for you guys on a day-to-day basis? And how do you think that we're dealing with it as an industry?
There's a lot of questions there.
You're lucky you only got three. Normally, yeah. The Rachel Smith compound question's got at least eight. So, yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to remember. I think companies are a bit more scared than they need to be honest. I think the ad tech industry is rightly concerned. And I think the advertising industry is probably rightly concerned, but I don't think brands, I mean, they obviously care, but they don't care that much. Because it, you know, it's not part of the brand or the advertiser's day job to be concerned about the deprecation of third-party cookies. It's like, you know, who cares? And we probably don't understand enough about it and how it funds publishers and how ad tech companies are impacted by it and how it looks like Google is trying to make a more monopolistic approach to ad tech. So I think generally advertisers aren't that concerned. I think if you go and speak to the WFA, the sort of top advertisers are quite concerned about it. But I'm pretty sure that some of those don't, some of us, because I'm part of it as well, don't understand it fully. You know, someone was saying to me that verification wouldn't work because third-party cookie deprecation, and that's just not true. So I think there's a lot of misinformation out there and people not really aware of the impact yet. From our perspective, I think we're pretty well set up. I mean, we're primarily on the Google stack. It doesn't mean we're going to be using Flock and Fledge and Turtle Dove and whatever else they're all called. But we've tried to diversify the stack over the last couple of years. So we've got more DSPs, and we work with some SSPs as well to try and get away from the reliance on Google. But that's not to say what Google are doing is wrong, because I kind of think the idea of cohorts and eradicating identifiers is actually the right thing to do. I just don't like the fact that it sits with Google. Mm. You know what I mean? I kind of think there should be some sort of regulatory body that oversees the available data that's used by advertisers, and that it should all be anonymized. And that just isn't in place. And there's no regulation to stop the abuse of flock or cohorts or whatever is going to be used, or, you know, universal IDs. So in general, I kind of think the deprecation of cookies is a good thing. Although, again, are they as accurate as we all think they are anyway in terms of targeting? I mean, there's so much bullshit about how accurate they are and, you know, like the surveillance capitalism that goes on. But I think there's reports from like Nielsen DAR a couple of years ago that looked at the accuracy of cookies. And if you targeted, I think it was like 15 to 34 year old man, and you used targeting techniques via cookies, I think it was 30% accurate. So you're better off flipping a coin than using the targeting techniques that cookies use. So I think there is an element that we've overestimated the importance of them. I think we're as a brand are relatively comfortable with where we were, and we were prepared for the deprecation of cookie this year, rather than, I think Google put it off to 2023, haven't they?
That's right. Yep.
So I think with our agency Mediacom, they kind of got us in a really good place, ready for it. You know, diversifying the stack, moving away from programmatic for the branded advertising, still using it for performance, but then building an ecosystem that we can use that we feel is brand safe. So they did a fantastic job getting us ready. Now we can just put our feet up for 2 years. So it's lovely.
Sounds like you're in a great place.
Yeah, well, they're a good agency. I was going to say something else, but I've forgotten.
I distracted you. Sorry. There's lots in that. I mean, it's really interesting because this touches on a number of conversations we've been having, you know, either partially on our podcasts or our webcasts, but also here in the office and just with other colleagues across the industry. Firstly, the notion of how effective were third-party cookies in the first instance, and, you know, contextual targeting is becoming very popular again, and there's plenty of people arguing that it's just as, if not more effective, depending on how you use it and what other tools you maybe add to it. So that's an interesting conversation in and of itself. And then there's the idea that actually isn't this all about what is a better advertising ecosystem for us to all be operating in? And surely that's one where consumers and customers have more control over how their data is used and over what they're seeing and consuming. And therefore, there is some level of kind of regulation that makes people, everyone within the advertising ecosystem, behave responsibly and in a particular way. And then actually, it's really important for any business, no matter where in that advertising value chain you are, to make sure that you're not reliant on one single customer, one single marketplace, one single technology solution. You know, the idea is diversification is supposed to be a healthy approach, right? You know, the snapshot that you've just provided us there of your own opinions and also what's going on at Adidas, you know, really paints a picture that actually you have approached this in a pretty front-footed way, and you're handing a lot of the credit for that over to your excellent agency, which is great. But then I wonder what happens to brands that aren't in the position that you were in. I mean, I suppose it's, you know, for me, it feels unimaginable that other large global brands wouldn't be in the same position as you. But because you also said, which I can completely understand, some marketers don't really care very much about this because it's not part of their day job. And also perhaps because it has been potentially a little overblown by some corners of the industry to some extent. So therefore, you know, I don't know. Is everyone in the same healthy shape?
No, I don't think that's true. I think companies that aren't so reliant on performance are probably more comfortable. You know, if they don't have their own e-commerce element, then they're probably not so into the tracking element of digital advertising anyway. I think it's companies that have a large performance part of their organisation or their advertising that are probably more concerned about. And I imagine those are probably the ones that are further ahead. But I saw an article that was kind of related to this. I thought it was quite interesting, by Dr. Augustine Fu. Do you ever read his name?
Yes, we know Dr. Fu. Yes,
we do indeed.
Someone sent a link yesterday where he asked, basically, it was about iOS 14.5 and IDFA, and he was basically asking, you know, will stupid advertisers move money off of iOS platforms because they can no longer track the ad? So is the KPI more important than the objective? So basically, you know, just because an ad isn't tracked anymore in the same way, does it make it more ineffective? Doesn't, like, why would you change your behavior, like, from 1 month to the next just because tracking of a certain type disappears? And it's interesting. I think it's really interesting because it's more about our addiction to the KPI, particularly in performance, but true of brand advertising as well. It's more about the addiction of the KPI than the effectiveness of the advertising. And I know that's not totally related to third-party cookie deprecation, but there's still something in that, which is, you know, if you're a performance advertiser, I'm sure you're going to be more concerned about all of this than branded advertisers that don't have a performance element. And you're probably more likely to end up with the likes of Google and Amazon, because either Flock is available or Amazon have a huge ID solution. So I think that's quite interesting. And also, like, I think someone was telling me that there's 10 quite large ID solutions at the moment. That's probably going to be whittled down to 2 or 3. But again, it's kind of still using a lot of the invasive technologies that we've been using over the last 10 years. And it's kind of like, well, isn't the point of all of this to get away from that and to have a healthier ecosystem? And I'm not suggesting that they're doing wrong by it. Because actually having that fragmentation and diversification within the industry helps it be more sustainable. So you kind of got these, it's almost like a paradox, or there's ambivalence, because in a way you kind of hate Google for doing all of this. And you know that they're trying to build like a larger monopolistic approach to ad technology and everything, you know, this monoculture that goes through Google. But at the same time, there's an element of that approach which is quite privacy-centric and is quite good. And then you've got more independent companies that are trying to provide diversified technologies and solutions that tend to be much more transparent than Google. But they're still using almost like an old cookie solution. It's just, you know, first-party data instead of third-party cookies. So it's kind of like you've got this ambivalence where you're on the side of the independent technology company because they're independent and they're trying to do the right thing. But at the same time, you don't necessarily like the technology that they're using. And then everyone hates Google. but arguably... Yeah, when you're using them. But arguably the methodology that they're applying is probably the right one. It's just, again, why does it have to be sat with Google? Shouldn't it be sat in some sort of regulatory body or some sort of independent third party that we all tap into? So there's this weird ambivalence that personally I have about third party cookie deprecation.
But also I think that expresses the dilemma that's facing the industry right now, this sort of crossroads that we're at, and it expresses to some extent, or rather it's commentary to some extent of how the industry has evolved. And all of those issues that you raise are extremely relevant, including measurement, right? And tracking. And that's an enormously important conversation that I still think we're just at the start of really unraveling all of that properly. Some of it is a bit of a fine line and a fine balance, this notion of creating a sort of privacy first, transparent ecosystem, and who's got the responsibility or the capability of doing that, versus the sort of ecosystem that currently exists at the moment. but at the same time trying to make sure that there is some sense of, you know, sort of independence and innovation and creativity and growth in the industry. And some of it, I think, is just part and parcel of transformation and change, which typically is much slower than anyone ever wants it to be and is much less dramatic than anyone ever wants it to be. We can often articulate when we're going through change where we want to get to or what we think things ought to look like, but getting there is a whole other story. And the other thing, just my final point on that, because I'm sure Lindsay, you've got something to say here too. My other final point on that is I think your idea of there being a regulatory body or something that provides some kind of foundational basis or oversight is extremely important. But I still think as an industry, we're very far away from designing that and getting and even having a useful conversation about whose hands that ought to be in.
It's down to the question, like it doesn't just apply to third-party cookies. It applies to a lot of stuff that happens in the industry. It applies to kind of everything related to any kind of privacy, really, is should who controls this? Should it be down to legal regulation? Should it be code as law, which is code as in something created by the likes of Google or Amazon or whoever else? Or should it be like regulation as law that actually defines it and then enforces it from a regulatory perspective? Or should it sit, you know, should it sit by a democratized third party body or a consortium of those kinds of bodies? But that is the problem, is those consortia normally contain the likes of Google and Facebook in them, and they then have controlling stakes because they put a lot of the investment in. So even then, can you really say that this is a completely kind of independent third party body with no skin in the game? You kind of can't. Do publishers control the likes of, you know, given that they're the ones with the data, do they control the likes of cohorts and everything else? It's an interesting one. And I think that, you know, as you sort of both said, we're a long way away from getting to grips with it, getting to the bottom of it.
Definitely. And yeah, we just need to be having more of these conversations and asking questions and continually asking questions. I was a little bit sort of disheartened by the MOJ in the US having their cases for anti-competition against Google and Facebook sort of thrown out of the US courts because they weren't substantial enough. I mean, I think actually that's just an indication for them to go back and do a bit more work on them. But the point behind this is not just to sort of, you know, kind of watch the sideshow. It's actually to get somewhere, to achieve something, which is not just about breaking down monopolistic companies, which can become irritating for many reasons, but also it's about creating some pillars for a much more mature, sustainable advertising and marketing industry and ecosystem. And yeah.
The role of ad tech changes in that completely.
100%.
The role of ad tech completely transforms versus what its role has been for the past 10 years. And that is where that's where the interesting thing is.
Definitely.
How they have to transform.
The measurement piece, I think, is also really interesting.
Yeah.
With the death of the third-party cookie, then attribution is basically over. So I think for like big advertisers, that's okay, because maybe you can afford an alternative model. Maybe you can afford to go and buy econometric modelling. But the problem with econometric modelling, firstly, it's really slow. So if you're in a performance team, you don't necessarily want to use it. And then it probably says that performance advertising doesn't work as well as we think it does. That's probably also something.
A bit of a problem.
Yeah, a bit of a problem. But it's also the cost of it, you know, the time and the cost. So for smaller advertisers that can't afford to do that everywhere, you know, what solution are they going to use to understand the efficacy of those ads? Even if that efficacy is wrong, it's still something to support them investing in a certain area. So I think that is a big area that I think a lot of companies are going to benefit from. You know, if you look at the econometric companies out there, particularly the smaller ones that are coming up, they're going to benefit from a lot of companies moving to that approach.
Yeah. So interesting. I'd love to keep chatting, but we've run out of time. And so I'm going to draw a line under it. Thank you very much for joining us, Simon. I must say you're looking very tanned as well. Don't tell me Amsterdam is another one of these bloody cities in Europe where you're having a fantastic summer and it's just here in London where it feels like we're suddenly living on the west coast of Ireland.
I get ripped all the time that I use fake tan. Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think maybe it's jaundice. It's certainly not that sunny here today.
Well, that is an excellent brand of fake tan. Highly recommend it. It's very believable. Lindsay, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.